This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The 14th Amendment may be the most hotly debated 2,000 words in American history. It was adopted on July 9, 1868, and is considered the most important of the Reconstruction Amendments. Those amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, reconfigure the relationship between the states and the federal government. Among other things, they put the federal government in the position of monitoring the way states protect civil rights. As part of our series, North Carolina Voices, the Civil War, we're going to consider states' rights and just how the war changed our Constitution and our laws. Joining us now is Michael Gerhart, the Samuel Ashe Distinguished Professor in Constitutional Law. He's also the director of the Center for Law and Government at UNC's Law School. Michael, welcome back to the program. Good to have you here.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with this phrase, states' rights. What do we mean when we say states' rights?
Well, a lot of what we might mean by that depends on what the speaker intends. Usually, states' rights refer to one of two things. They might refer to state powers, what powers states might be given by the Constitution or were not taken away by the Constitution. The other thing that it might mean is state sovereignty, the extent to which the state may not be interfered with or breached by the federal government.
And so for the first, well, up until the Civil War, certainly, the states had quite a bit of sovereignty. The Constitution was very clear. Everything that's not in this document is up to the states.
One of the critical things that was done by the original Constitution was it left the states under no federal control whatsoever when it came to what we refer to as civil rights. So those things that are spelled out in the Bill of Rights, such things as freedom of speech or even the right to bear arms or the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, all those things were areas over which states had complete control. And that's how things stood up until the brink of the Civil War.
Now, that's an interesting point because it's in a federal document. It's in a document that applies to all of those states, all 13 at the time, and then more as they were added. These are rights guaranteed by the United States government. How is it that states were free to interpret that any way they wanted?
Well, the states weren't free to interpret it any way they wanted. In fact, the states were not necessarily uniform on how it was interpreted. But it was a general understanding that was shared by enough of the people in power that it came to be accepted by, for example, the United States Supreme Court, that the Bill of Rights did not apply to the states, and the states were given more or less complete sovereignty over this. Part of the problem that led to the Civil War is that the states had complete sovereignty over this, and without anybody looking over their shoulder or trying to check their judgment, they were doing some pretty awful things when it came to what we think of as civil rights.
And this starts to come to a head mostly in the debate over slavery. Tell us about the Dred Scott case and how it figures into states' rights.
Well, Dred Scott, of course, is one of the big events preceding the Civil War. In Dred Scott, the United States Supreme Court faced pretty much for the first time the basic question of what power it had to review and exercise a federal power that interfered with slavery. The specific federal power that was at issue in that case had to do with the federal government's effort to regulate slavery from going into territories that were owned by the federal government. In a split decision by the Supreme Court of the United States, the court, in an opinion by Chief Justice Taney, said several things. First of all, it said that African Americans were never intended to be citizens of the United States. That in itself was pretty remarkable because one thing it did was it disenfranchised any of the African Americans in northern cities, even African Americans who participated in ratification. They were suddenly, by a matter of constitutional law, ruled not to be citizens of the United States. The second thing it held, which was pretty remarkable, was that the federal government didn't have the power to keep slavery out of the territories because it interfered with the Fifth Amendment. The court said that the Fifth Amendment protected the right of slave owners to take slaves wherever they wanted without being interfered with by the federal government. And that meant that there was now a fundamental right that slave owners had to own people as property. And it was up to states to define whether or not certain people could qualify as property.
So the law had spoken, and if slavery was to be abolished, it would now have to happen by war, and it did.
Yes, it didn't really leave much choice as to what other alternatives were available. It took the entire matter out of the political process, pretty much. It certainly meant that now it was a matter of constitutional law, and the only way to overrule it was either to get the Supreme Court to overrule itself, to get the Constitution ratified or, as we find out, to fight a civil war.
And in the aftermath of the Civil War, we have the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, and they are much more specific about the role of the federal government in this. Let's talk about those.
Yes, they do a lot of things. These are called the Reconstruction Amendments. One of the things they do is they obliterate Dred Scott. They overrule that decision in no uncertain way. And the 13th Amendment outlaws slavery. So forever after, the ratification of the 13th Amendment guarantees there'll be no more slavery in the United States. The 14th Amendment is viewed by many people as sort of the crown jewel of these Reconstruction Amendments, and it has many different parts, three of which are critical for modern constitutional law. And then the 15th Amendment deals with voting rights. So all these amendments together reconstruct in a way or redefine the relationship between the states and the federal government when it comes to civil rights.
Now, it's interesting, again, getting back to the Bill of Rights and the relationship of these so-called Reconstruction Amendments. In effect, there's not much more in there than is in the Bill of Rights. It just is more clear about the federal government's responsibility to monitor.
I think that's one thing that's made clear. But there was another issue that had not been very clear up until Dred Scott, and certainly not up until the ratification of the Reconstruction Amendments, and that was who had the ultimate authority under the Constitution. In other words, from what power did the Constitution derive? If you believed that it derived from states, what that meant then is you believed that the states would have power unless it was explicitly taken away from them by the document, by the Constitution. If you believed the power might have come from the people of the United States, as some people did, particularly in the North, then they would have felt that the critical power under the Constitution was vested in the federal government, and that whenever you have a gap or ambiguity in the document, it's read in favor of the federal government. If you believe the states were the ultimate authority from which the Constitution derived, you believe gaps or ambiguity should be defined or interpreted in their favor.
So what these constitutions did was make it very clear that the U.S. government, and particularly Congress, had the right to pass laws that governed these kinds of questions.
Right. The critical part of that, I think, is these kinds of questions. So it certainly redefined the relationship between states and the federal government, but in this realm.
And you have so you have a set of constitutional amendments that clarify previous constitutional amendments, but still it takes about 100 years before the legislation, both the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, embody these principles into law that's meaningful.
That is correct. I mean, one of the other parts of this story is that it takes decades in order for Congress to be able to pass a major civil rights bill that the Supreme Court will not strike down. And it's a long journey. And the first major civil rights bill that's really passed after the Civil War that survives any kind of judicial review was passed in 1958. But that wasn't really as major as what was going to be coming down the road about 6 years later, the principal civil rights bill of the modern era, which is the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So that's almost 100 years after the Civil War before you get a major piece of federal civil rights legislation that the Supreme Court will uphold.
But maybe not the first attempt. Talk about the earlier attempts to use the Constitution, these new amendments, particularly the 14th Amendment, equal protection under the law. With Jim Crow laws passed in the South, it would seem pretty clear that this is not equal protection, and yet it was protected. What were the challenges?
Well, there are two different things going on here. The first is we ought to remember what are the different parts of the 14th Amendment. I had mentioned earlier it had sort of three parts. There's one part that provides for the protection of the privileges or immunities of the citizens of the United States. The Supreme Court nullifies that out of existence pretty much at the get-go. So that one falls aside. That might have been a source for the protection of unenumerated or implicit fundamental rights, but that's going to fall by the wayside pretty quickly in American history. Then we have another clause which forbids states from interfering with the equal protection of the laws. And then there's the third clause that protects people from having their property, life, or liberty taken away from them without due process of law. There's another part of the 14th Amendment, and this gets us to the second part, that provides explicitly for Congress to have the power to enforce the guarantees of the 14th Amendment. So that meant to some people that Congress would have an independent authority from the courts to be able to enforce the guarantees of the 14th Amendment, particularly equal protection, as they understood it. It would be that understanding that would ultimately be ratified in the 1964 Civil Rights Act. But then to come back to your question about Jim Crow, there was a persistent question or a question that was kind of percolating both at the time of the ratification of the 14th Amendment and later about what did equal protection guarantee to African Americans. And one thing it might have guaranteed, and the court in fact did say this, is it meant that you couldn't pass a law that it was explicitly discriminatory against African Americans. But something that it had much more trouble dealing with was whether or not a law that seemed to be treating whites and blacks equally was could be discriminatory. And the example of that was a Jim Crow law, which would be state-mandated segregation of the races in different public areas, such as schools.
And that was supported and validated by Plessy versus Ferguson.
Right. So in the 1890s, the Supreme Court decides with only one dissenting vote to uphold this doctrine called separate but equal, maintaining that the 14th Amendment was not designed to eradicate a law that would treat supposedly blacks and whites equally, but still require that they be separated or segregated into a public facility such as rail cars, swimming pools, or schools.
Quite obviously, that was not the end of the debate. We'll talk more about how the 14th Amendment in particular played a role and continues to play a role in American politics today. Debate over what that amendment means. Talking about that today on The State of Things as we look at part of the fallout of the Civil War, part of our North Carolina Voices series. All that continues with my guest, Michael Gerhardt, on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, and today talking about how the Civil War changed our Constitution. It's part of our series, North Carolina Voices, The Civil War. Constitutional scholar and professor Michael Gerhardt from UNC's School of Law is with us in the studio. And Michael, we're talking about the 14th Amendment providing equal protection under the law, but it takes about 100 years before there was legislation passed. It's the beginning in 1958 that really begins to flesh out what the amendment intended. Let's talk about some of the legislation and how it worked.
Okay. One thing to note is at the outset, right after the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were ratified, Congress tried to pass a pretty comprehensive and ambitious civil rights law, which the Supreme Court very quickly struck down. And that kind of set the stage for making it harder for Congress to have an independent voice in trying to construe the scope of the guarantees of the Reconstruction Amendments. But then later, come 1958, under the leadership of Lyndon Johnson in the Senate and other leaders, Congress fashions a new civil rights bill, but that itself sets the stage for the major civil rights bill, which is the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which ironically is very close to, if not identical, with the law that was struck down by the Supreme Court in the 1870s.
Can we talk about that? Why was it struck down, on what grounds, and what did it provide for?
It was struck down on the grounds that Congress didn't have the power under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, which is the power that it's got to enforce the 14th Amendment, that Congress doesn't have the power there to be able to regulate private action. It can regulate state action, that is to say the action of states, but it couldn't regulate private action. Therefore, when Congress attempted in the civil rights bill that was struck down in the 1870s to regulate private discrimination against blacks, let's say in restaurants and hotels, the Supreme Court struck that down. And they struck it down on the ground that this is private action and the 14th Amendment doesn't reach private action. It only regulates the activities of government. But in 1964, under a new theory of the Constitution, particularly of the Commerce Clause, the Supreme Court ended up ruling differently. So the theory was that Congress has been given the power under the Constitution, and it does have this power explicitly, to regulate interstate commerce, that this means that Congress has the power to regulate commercial or economic activities that might have an impact on interstate commerce. And one of those activities might be discrimination. So in fact, if you keep people from participating in interstate commerce, such as being able to eat in a restaurant or stay at a hotel if they're trying to travel across interstate lines, then you're actually impeding interstate commerce. Supreme Court accepted that. They said this makes perfect sense to us. And on that basis, they uphold the 64 Civil Rights Act, and that's the law we have to this day.
Does this reflect a change in the world that we're living in, a more interconnected world where travel is easier? Also, may it reflect the fact that government is involved in more aspects of our life and so therefore more likely to be tripping over a right that the government's involved in?
I think it does reflect that, though I do think from almost the beginning, the Supreme Court of the United States, this is particularly under the leadership of John Marshall, recognized that the Commerce Clause might provide one of those means for helping not just to create, but to support a national economy. And so I think in a way, this 1964 Civil Rights Bill becomes a natural consequence of not just early rulings, but of, let's say, a later realization of the Supreme Court that interstate commerce can, in fact, be impeded by private conduct such as discrimination.
And as we said, the 14th Amendment may be at the root of most of our political battles today, certainly was back then. And let's take a look at some of the other fallout from this legislation or from the amendment itself. The Miranda case, for instance.
Yes, that actually turns on another very controversial, at least controversial at the time, notion that came along with the 14th Amendment. So one question that came up with the 14th Amendment was what, if any, rights did it protect that were not spelled out as such in its text? So the way we say this is, did the 14th Amendment protect any unenumerated or implied fundamental rights? And one set of those rights might be contained in the Bill of Rights. The question becomes, was the 14th Amendment intended in any way to apply to the states some or maybe even all of the Bill of Rights? This is a process known as incorporation. And Miranda was one of those cases that came down by the Warren Court. And one of its most significant acts was to incorporate many of the amendments in the Bill of Rights that apply to the criminal process by revolutionizing the relationship, in a sense, between federal courts and state criminal procedures. What the Warren Court did was it put a stop to an area over which states had complete sovereignty before then. So, for example, if states took people into custody, they could just simply beat a confession out of people. And there was nothing until incorporation that seemed to prevent that.
So how do issues like gay marriage, for instance, test the 14th Amendment?
So one of the questions that comes up under the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause is what exactly does that guarantee entail? And to whom is this guarantee promised? The 14th Amendment guarantees to any person the equal protection of the laws. The question becomes, who qualifies as a person for purposes of the clause? Then a related question is, what is equal protection guarantee to that person? So we can probably accept that gay people would qualify as persons under the clause. Then the question becomes, what does it exactly guarantee them? And in some recent rulings, the Supreme Court has held that laws that disadvantage people because of their sexual orientation actually do violate equal protection, because those laws, by definition, are treating these people less well than others without any credible or plausible justification. What the Supreme Court has said is the only thing that can explain laws that have been passed that disadvantage gays and lesbians is animus or hatred or bias, not some rational or plausible justification. And thus, with a level of scrutiny that is generally pretty differential, the Supreme Court has said that even laws passed against gays can't pass that standard, that they'll be struck down.
And how about gun control? We have a right to keep and bear arms.
Well, gun control is going to function a little differently because of the Second Amendment. So as we know, recently in two different decisions, the Supreme Court has said, first, the Second Amendment protects an individual's right to own a handgun. And then in another more recent case, the Supreme Court applied that amendment to states. So now we have two decisions which seem to direct that states and the federal government have to be very careful when they go about trying to control the use of handguns.
Now, again, the part of the problem is defining just what is a right that you might be deprived of. So when we get to, say, overcrowding in prisons, do you have a right to X amount of space? And what is your right as an incarcerated human being? Does that apply?
Yeah. So this now gets us into another controversial area, and that is, how do we interpret the terms of the Constitution, particularly the Bill of Rights? So we might run into different kinds of challenges depending upon which parts of the Constitution we're looking at. So you just referred to overcrowding of prisons. That's going to raise a question under the Eighth Amendment, which has been recognized as applying to the states. Eighth Amendment bars what's called cruel and unusual punishment. That's usually a comparative analysis. Cruelty is usually determined by what perhaps the framers might have thought was cruel. But then the term unusual requires looking at how other states might treat something to determine whether or not this stands out as unusual or something that perhaps should not be done. So overcrowding, according to a recent Supreme Court decision, was thought to constitute something that was unusual and therefore violative of the Eighth Amendment. And so that's how the court went about it determining the scope of that amendment. But other amendments have broad terms, and there's a tremendous debate. We see this reflected in judicial confirmation hearings all the time about how do we interpret these broad terms. Do we interpret them on the basis of original meaning, what the framers thought they meant? Do we interpret them on the basis of, let's say, subsequent generations' understandings? Where do we look for guidance? That's a big question that divides the court.
Well, I wonder if the question of the 14th Amendment has any bearing on some of the more controversial issues that we face legislatively, healthcare, for instance.
Well, certainly some of the same issues we've been talking about are going to come up with regard to the debate right now over the individual mandate provision in the most recent healthcare bill. And these issues all relate to the Interstate Commerce Clause. So just as we said, the Interstate Commerce Clause provided a basis for the 1964 Civil Rights Law based on a new theory. One question that's come up is whether that same theory might actually provide a basis for this healthcare provision. For example, Congress took the position that requiring everybody or most everybody to purchase healthcare insurance was needed in order to ensure better access and cost control when it comes to healthcare. So Congress's theory was that this is all an economic activity. It all has economic ramifications, especially if left unregulated, and thus Congress should in fact take the initiative to try and do something to solve the problem. Notice how this reflects everything we just talked about, Congress taking the initiative, so having an independent voice. Also, it reflects the issue about what's the scope of the Interstate Commerce Clause.
So, again, an argument that, well, it's my right to have it or not, is trumped in a sense by Congress's responsibility or right to be the voice and the enforcer of, in this case, the 14th Amendment.
I'm not so sure that it would be accurate to say that there's a right involved here. That is to say, I have a right not to purchase it. What it might come down to, as far as legal analysis is concerned, is whether Congress has the authority to reach this kind of inactivity. So this will also take us full circle back to the question of what areas of the state were left untouched by Reconstruction, but also by newer understandings of the Interstate Commerce Clause.
I want to take a look back for just a moment at some of the odd twists and turns that both constitutional amendments and legislation take over time. The 14th Amendment guarantees equal protection under the law. It's passed in the aftermath of the Civil War. It has slavery in mind and what happens to African Americans in their new world of freedom. And yet it was used to also essentially make corporations into human beings.
Yes. Actually, in one of its earliest rulings after the Civil War, the Supreme Court construed the term person in the Equal Protection Clause. Recall the Equal Protection Clause guarantees to each person the equal protection of the laws. The Supreme Court held that persons includes corporations and thus applied the clause to corporations and ensured that they were insured equal protection of the laws. About the same time, the Supreme Court found that women didn't qualify as persons for purposes of equal protection. That revolution was going to take many years to come.
I mean, it's kind of interesting to think about this, isn't it? Because there were challenges on all sorts of grounds at various levels. African Americans taking challenging laws, Jim Crow laws, on the basis of the 14th Amendment, those are not overturned. So to that extent, you might say, and I suppose it's controversial, the 14th Amendment did not a very good job in protecting their rights. Corporations' rights, almost instantly, they're taken to court. Corporate lawyers saying you can't tax us differently than humans. They win. Women, they lose.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot going on here. So what we're going to find is actually the 14th Amendment did try to do a lot. But in some ways, the country is still fighting battles over what the meaning of the 14th Amendment happens to be. And those battles generally, this is a bit of an oversimplification, generally about how broadly or narrowly should we construe the 14th Amendment. And some people want to construe it quite narrowly. They want to construe it as meaning only with respect to discrimination against blacks. Did the 14th Amendment really reconstruct the relationship between the federal government and states? Others want to read it more broadly. They want to say, well, gee, it's not just blacks, but it might be people in comparable positions to blacks. And we should try to prevent the government from treating people the same as it did treat blacks at one time. So there's a debate about that. And you can see this reflected in almost all the modern Supreme Court opinions on equal protection. And one of the big issues that's confronting the Roberts Court sooner or later is whether it's going to uphold the recertification of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. This is one of the two major pieces of civil rights legislation enacted in the modern era. The 1964 Civil Rights Act seems to be secure, but the future of the 1965 voting rights is not so secure.
On what grounds? Why would it be overturned?
I think the argument's going to be that its need has lessened, and its requirements are sort of overblown, or they're much broader than we need to be able to fight the specific battles we might need to fight when it comes to discrimination with respect to voting. So the thinking might be the Voting Rights Act is just simply not needed anymore.
And the Voting Rights Law did name specific states who were mostly in violation. These are the southern states with Jim Crow laws.
Yes, although again, the question becomes whether or not it still makes sense to have those states singled out under the Act, number one, and number two, to what extent can they opt out from coverage? To what extent are the procedures in the Act still make sense, given the way the world looks in whatever year the court hears the case?
So you talked about the fact that there was an attempt to create a Civil Rights Act in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War and the passage of the 14th Amendment. Were there, and that was overturned by the court, were there consistent efforts throughout, or did the movement to create an act not arise again until the 1950s?
There were not many efforts to bring civil rights back as a form of legislation until the 1950s. And even then, it was a little bit lukewarm, though it would have seemed gigantic at the time. And what it suggests is that it's very hard to overcome a Supreme Court decision that is negative, or a Supreme Court decision that restricts Congress is something that Congress itself might have a long time and a hard time trying to overcome, if it ever does. Ultimately, we see that happen with the 64 Civil Rights Act, but that's probably more the exception than it is the rule.
And what accounted for that exception? Why then?
Well, as we said, I think the main thing is the government, particularly the federal government, of course, came forward with an entirely different theory to support the act in 1964. They granted it on the Interstate Commerce Clause and not on the 14th Amendment. And because the Interstate Commerce Clause does give Congress some authority over private activity, that became a more sensible basis as far as the court was concerned.
Is it fair to say, do you think, that the 14th Amendment really is at the center of most of our political debates and divisions today?
Yes. I think it is still very much one of the most controversial aspects of our Constitution that is debated, I think, pretty much every day.
And I guess the question is what is privileged? Who is privileged? If you don't feel you're privileged, then you think that a law that's aimed at somehow changing the way things work is not necessary. I don't have a privilege. Why are you doing this to me?
Well, and there are a lot of issues that come up when we think about the 14th Amendment. And these issues, perhaps sadly, or maybe just it's a fact, are very similar to the ones that were being debated at the time the 14th Amendment went into effect. But there are issues about who gets to define the 14th Amendment. Is it the court? Is that right? Or should it be Congress? There's an issue about, okay, what about implicit fundamental rights? Which part of the 14th Amendment is meant to cover that? Many scholars think it might have been the Privileges or Immunities Clause, but that's dead now as far as the Supreme Court is concerned. So we're left then with the question, well, what other clause might make sense, and where do we look again for guidance in interpreting the 14th Amendment? Questions of interpretation of the 14th Amendment are very much alive and well in Congress, in the states, and certainly on the Supreme Court.
And questions of the keenness of the law. If, as you suggest, the Voting Rights Act is somewhat anachronistic today, is there a theory now, a new theory, that would, A, protect the civil rights against those who, you know, for whatever reason might want to restrict the vote, but be more in keeping with the times, a better argument?
Well, there might be. I think one of the things that we have to kind of watch out for is if we're thinking about voting rights, we have to recognize that voting rights are special guarantees that were not given by the 14th Amendment. They had to pass another amendment to ensure that the voting rights of African Americans, for example, were guaranteed. So we are kind of out of the realm of the 14th Amendment there, looking more specifically at the 15th Amendment, at the 15th Amendment, in dealing with a lot of questions about voting rights. And then the other question that comes up has to do with the extent to which there are certain things that legislatures may do that affect voting, such as drawing district lines, what's called gerrymandering. To what extent should that be subject to judicial review or the court's review under the 14th Amendment? That remains a fairly controversial issue as well. And one of the reasons why the Warren Court is always thought to be fairly controversial is because it took a strong stand on a lot of these different things. It felt that gerrymandering did raise questions about equal protection. It actually construed the 14th and 15th Amendments as giving Congress an independent voice on the enforcement of these guarantees. It revolutionized incorporation. And if we think about it, almost all of those are issues that we're still hearing kind of a pushback on or getting a pushback on or debating again in the halls of Congress and of the court.
Michael, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael Gerhardt is Samuel Ashe Distinguished Professor in Constitutional Law and Director of the Center for Law and Government at UNC's School of Law. Coming up after a short break, Miss North Carolina. No, seriously, we're going to talk about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.